The following is an unrehearsed interview with Mr. John D. Pete Feather by Debbie Wilson for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at the Souders Nursing Home in Broadhead, Kentucky on July 21, 1978 at 2:30 p.m. The first thing I want to start with, Mr. Feather, is just some background questions. Now, what is your full name?
John Dishman Feather.
And what have y'all been known as?
What is that?
What is your nickname?
Pete.
Well, now, where were you born?
I was born in Corbin, Kentucky.
When?
On West Center Street, the 28th day of August, 1896.
Who were your parents?
Harry Feather and Mary Dishman Feather.
Well, where were you educated at?
Well, I was educated in the Corbin schools, or partially educated there. I went to work for myself when I was 16 years old. And after the railroad company put the jobs on 8-hour spread, the 8 hours came into fashion. I beat in the second trick job and went to school in the morning and worked in the afternoon for the railroad company. And by making that sacrifice or change, I was enabled to get a complete high school education. When I originally left school, I was only in the second year high school. And after a period of time elapsed, I became interested in Union College at Barberville. And I had Dr. Oler, who is now one of the physicians there in Corbett, take me up there with him and I could interview the faculty up there and see about entering college. And I entered college, but I can't tell you the date of that. I only know that I was there 7 years.
At Union College?
I had to carry what they call a part-time schedule. And 12 hours college work was as much as I could carry, which required me to be there on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, or when I changed subjects, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. And I went one full term of summer school up there. In all, I was there 7 years. I worked off my AB degree with a major in English and a minor in history.
Went out.
Those were the two subjects that I was particularly interested in. And I had one course in that English course. It was journalism. When I told you a while ago that I had a stock phrase, I'd go up to strangers and ask them what they called their name and tell them who I was.
Did you work for a newspaper or just what was your occupation?
No, I never worked for a newspaper in my life. I never did any work except for the railroad company.
How many years were you with the railroad?
52 years.
Now, was that the L&N or some other?
It was the L&N. Louisville Nashville Railroad for 52 years. I have a wristwatch down there in my lockbox for over 50 years service with them that was presented to me when I retired.
How long have you been retired?
Well, I can't tell you. I've been here 10 years, and I must have been retired. I retired when I was 65 years of age. I had to then, because I was on the railroad men's pension, and I had paid into Social Security since 1939, and part of the time I paid double into that Social Security because I had another job on the side. And from my salary on that side job, they had to deduct the amount that was prescribed under the law and send it in too.
Well, Mr. Feather, have you ever been married?
No, I've never been married.
Well, we'll move on from your personal background now to Corbin. I understand that you're real familiar with the history of the town of Corbin, and that's what I'd like to discuss with you. Now, were your parents some of the early settlers in Corbin?
Oh, yes.
Well, can you tell me who some of Corbin's earliest families were?
My father went to Corbin with the railroad company to work for them. A single man, and he met my mother there, who was a school teacher in what they called the Christian Church College that was on the east side of Corbin. And that courtship resulted in a marriage. And he had a home on West Center Street now that was completely furnished. He took his bride to a home that was furnished throughout. But the street didn't go up there then. You just had a little path up through the woods to get to it. And her bridal dress was almost torn off of her with the briars. I remarked a while ago that I was born there in a briar patch.
Well, now, do you know when Corbin was established as a town?
It was in the 80s. It became a fourth or fifth class city along about 1881.
Well, now, who was the city of Corbin named after?
What is that?
How did Corbin get its name?
Well, it's named Corbin after a Christian church preacher. Old man Jimmy Eaton met him on the street the morning after. The town was originally called Lincoln, and then they changed it to Cummins after Uncle Jimmy Cummins, and the post office department wrote him that they couldn't use the name Cummins, that he'd have to supply them with another name for the place. And he met James Corbin Floyd and showed him the letter, and Floyd laughed and said, "Why not name it after me, Corbin?" And that's where it got its name.
Just sort of as an accident? Is that what you'd call it, just sort of an accident?
Well, yes, I guess it was more of an accident than anything else. This Nibrock festival that they have at Corbin now is just Corbin spelt backwards. You knew that, didn't you?
No, I didn't know that. I hadn't thought about it.
It's Corbin spelt backwards. They have that festival, I think, every year.
Well,
I've heard of the Nibrock Festival, but I just never thought about it being Corbin spelled backwards. Well, now.
Well, it is.
Who were some of the early families in Corbin? Do you have any idea? Other than your own family?
Well, I can't recall their first names. I'm hesitant about that.
Well, just some of their last names.
You take the Anders family. They were old citizens. And the Joneses. In fact, my father was boarding with Trace Jones at a rooming house that he ran for the railroad men when he met my mother. That's how he happened to meet her. She was boarding there and she had an older sister that worked there as one of the caretakers.
Was there any particular person or incident that helped in the formation of Corbin as a town?
Not that I recall.
Well, now, when did the railroad come to Corbin?
It must have got there in 1881, because my recollection of the script that I have over there on it. It is built to Livingston in 1870, but it had miles and miles to go to get to Laurel County, and up what they call Crooked Hill they had to dig 10 tunnels. There's 9 of them right on the hill. And one of them's down there just this side of Mount Vernon. They had those 9 tunnels to dig through, and they were 10 years of going from Livingston on to Corbin. But about the same time, there was a notation made that the railroad had reached Jellicoe, Tennessee. And that is in 1881. And this Cumberland Valley Division that goes up toward Pineville and Middlesbrough, Barberville, those towns that's to the east of Corbin, was completed in 1883. The railroad company worked from both ends, or the contractors did, and they started in Northern Virginia and came this way. And I don't know exactly when or where the railroads met. That is, the two constructions.
Now, which railroad company was this?
It is the Louisville and Nashville.
Well, now, what was the effect of the coming of the railroad? How did that influence Corbin?
Well, it made Corbin. There wasn't any Corbin there till the railroad company got there. A few years before, there was quite a group of citizens, the Cummins family. And the Archers and some others that lived in Woodbine. They pulled up stakes down there, that is 3 miles south of Corbin, and moved up there in the swamp where Corbin is, because they knew that the railroad company was coming there and it would be a junction point, a division point.
Well, now, did the arrival of the railroad, did that bring in a lot of new people?
Oh, yes. My father was originally out here at Roland, Kentucky, in the shops out there. That was as far as the railroad ran then. And he was moved to Corbin.
Well, Can you give me a description of early Corbin, you know, like some of the buildings, some of the early buildings in Corbin, and just how the town looked?
Well, I heard only a few days ago that one of those old buildings in Corbin had been demolished, and a filling station placed in its place. That was the old Congregational Church. That was the first church that I ever knew anything about or ever went to, was the Congregational. And it was over in the midst of the railroad Y. That was where they turned their engines. One that went south, you know, turned on that Y to come back north. And the old Congregational Church sat in there near the old roundhouse. And the Christian Church in those days was on the east side of town. And my mother didn't want me across the bridges to get over there to it. And she let Louise Moffitt accompany me to the Congregational Church. And that building, the railroad company moved the church building in 1906 to its location at 7th and Main. And I understand now that it's been torn down. The Congregational people added a parsonage, and they had it all on the same lot there, right next to the Robert Older home. But they tell me that there's a filling station there now at the Congregational Church. And I believe the 19th Street Methodist Church United. And we've not got a Congregational Church anymore in Corbin.
Well, now what were some of the other early buildings in Corbin?
Well, the old Masonic Hall was built in 1896. That was the year that I was born. It was at Main and Gordon on the northwest corner. And the downstairs of it, for many years, was used as a theater or a place for plays. And upstairs was their lodge hall. That's been replaced by a brick, and the city owns that property now, the city of Corbin, and I believe the fire department is in the north end of that building. The first brick building that ever was built in Corbin was on the corner of Center Street and Main. And for many years it housed the old Corbin Bank. That was a state bank. And finally they went out of business. And Dr. Bryant took the downstairs over and later on moved upstairs.
Well, now, what were the, you mentioned the first brick building. Could you describe to me how the buildings looked, the first early structures, like what they were made out of, and any stories?
Just a one-room structure below wind. Had two or three rooms upstairs. When I supervised the census in 1930, I had my office there in that very building. And I recall when they were building that, because our home then was on West Center Street, but we had moved from up there where I was born, down next to Uncle Joe Duty. Uncle Joe Duty was the cause of my having the wanderlust, wanting to go places to see things. And they practically raised me in a way. I was just as much at home in their home as I was at home.
So now, when did Corbin begin to get sidewalks?
When did Corbin begin to get what?
To get sidewalks and roads, you know, paved roads,
well,
concrete walls.
The original sidewalks there were out of flagstone. It was quarried out of the mountains and hauled in on wagons and placed end on end to get them over the muddy places. The first concrete or cement structure of any kind in the nature of a sidewalk was at first in Maine. That was across the street from the old Obstinate Hall. That's all been replaced by brick.
But at what kind of streets did Corbin have when you were a young boy?
He didn't have any. It was a mud hole from one end to the other. If you've been on Center Street there in Corbin, you'd notice where the post office sits. That hill there has been dug out and the dirt hauled off. That was behind our old home and near the old duty home. And that dirt was used to fill in Main Street to get rid of that swampy aspect. I've seen wagon loads of coal marred up there to the axles. I think the first paved street that we had was what they called Railroad Street then, and it's called Lynn Avenue now. It's down next to the railroad, east of Main Street, runs the same direction as Main, and that was the first paved street that was paved in Corbin. There was a fellow by the name of Chapman that put that street down for him.
Well, could you tell me about your early transportation before you got the paved roads?
Before we got what?
The paved roads in Corbin.
Riders with ox wagons, and the man that had mules and a wagon of that sort was indeed fortunate. I can remember when we used to cook, we didn't burn coal, or the people wouldn't burn it, because it is considered nasty. They burned what they called stove wood.
Well,
And there was an old man that lived in the Phelps district now, which is north of Corby, that drove two big white oxen and hauled stove wood in there for the people. I recall one instance of meeting him and telling him that we needed some stove wood. When we didn't, we had a wood house full. But I was an energetic, know-it-all kind of a person. And he drove those two oxen in the lane that was between our house and Captain Duty's, and had the wood partially unloaded when my mother heard him out there and went to see what was going on. And she just let him put the rest of the wood that he had on the wagon in the wood house. But we didn't need a stick of it at that time. We had plenty of wood. I was afraid, I guess, we'd run out.
He's gonna keep warm, huh?
And on the lower corner of the same street there was the old Francis and Steele store. That was Alec Francis and Alec Steele. They were partners. And it was an old wooden building, had a stairway that went up on the Lynn Avenue side. And in later years, Dr. Day had a dental office up there. As early as 1906, I was about 10 years old, when he had that dental office. Alec Steele and Alec Francis, after they opened up Oklahoma territory and admitted it as a state of the Union, they pulled up and moved to Oklahoma. And if they ever came back, I don't know it. Alec Francis originated out here in Montgomery County, and Alec Steele came to Corbin from the Rockhold district of Whitley County.
Do you remember when the first automobile came into Corbin?
Yes. Old man Hal Seeley, that was an engineer on the Cumberland Valley Division, brought the first automobile to Corbin that the people ever saw. And he was several weeks of getting it down from in Michigan where he bought it. It like to broke him up to get it here, or down there, because the roads were so bad between Corbin and up there that it was a constant fight with mud holes. They didn't have any pavements anywhere. It was a Ford, and Henry Pridmore, there was an engineer on the CV division, brought the second one to Corbin.
Do you know about when these early automobiles came into Corbin?
No, I can just tell you about them.
Well, what was the reaction of other people to the automobile?
Well, they came out to look at it.
Were they impressed or surprised?
They weren't interested in it at that time. And it was a long time that there was only the two cars in, Corby. And I think both of them were Fords.
Pardon me while I turn the tape over. This is side two of an interview with Mr. John D. Pete Feather. Now, Mr. Feather, before I turn the tape over, we were discussing the coming of the automobile to Corbin. Just how did the horses react to this?
Well, there were several runaways where the automobiles straddled them. And as I recall, there was one lawsuit over it in the Whitley Circuit Court. I don't remember the fellow's name. He was a teamster, a deliverer from the old LN freight station. And he was driving up town, and this automobile frightened his horse. And the horse ran away and completely tore the wagon up. It seems to me like that this man's name was Higgins. I won't be sure on that. Because there were so many of those fellows in that early day that hauled the merchandise from the LN freight house and delivered it to those stores. Another one that drove one of these delivery wagons was John Lumpkins. He lost an arm in the service of the railroad company and took up a job as a teamster for hauling merchandise to the various merchants. He had three or four big grown boys. And that is after we'd moved from Center Street to Poplar Street. We lived at Gordon and Poplar. And he was down the street about two blocks. You might say close to the intersection of First Street and Poplar.
You've mentioned the railroad several times, Mr. Feather. What were other ways to make a living in early Corbin besides the railroad?
Well, there wasn't much of anything to do there for a good many years. A whole lot of the people that lived around the town farmed, and they had a market for their products there in Corbin, and they'd bring it into the town in what we call peddler's wagons, which were usually drawn by two mules, and they'd go down one street and up another. Some of them would ring a bell to let them know that they were there, and the housewives would go out and buy such vegetables and things, well, butter and eggs and milk, and buttermilk. My mother has bought off of those wagons a many a time, right there on Gordon and Poplar Street. And some of that food stuff that they traded on was raised over there in what they call the Lynn Camp section. After Corbin gave up the name of Lynn Camp, it became Cummins, Kentucky, and the post office department notified them there's another Cummins there, another Cummins in this, on the map, and they'd have to change the name. And that's how they came to the name of Corbin. But this Lynn Camp, which is the name of the creek that runs through Corbin, is a settlement over there in the edge of Knox and Laurel County. The Sturgills and the Narvels and the Harrises and the Overs and the Stansberries, there's another family in there, and all of them were originally Methodists. There was a chapel in there that was built by the Methodist people. But I understand that in late years, the Baptist people have just about taken that whole country over back in there. It is about 6 miles from Corbin. You had to go out what we call Engineer Street. They got cityfied, and some of them that lived over there took a notion to change the name of Engineer Street, and they named it East Main. It's not a thing in the world, but a street of pure residents from one end to the other. Along the extreme east end of that, this Lynn Camp Road led off to the left and crossed over what was called Romine's Hill. The Romines family came to Corbin originally from Clay County, and there was a bunch of samples that lived in there, and they were men that worked in rock, in the rock quarries. The foundation of that old bank building that was on the corner of Main and Gordon was brought out of the rock quarries, and Ed Downing and Jim Downing's father was a stonemason, and every bit of that stone that made the foundation for that first brick building, he worked it out and fitted it together. I doubt if they had what we call cement now, I don't know what they stuck it with. They made some kind of a mortar up out of lime and sand, and probably stuck that brick building together with it. The building's still there.
What were some of the other jobs in early Corbin? Did you have a blacksmith?
What is that?
I said, what were some of the other jobs in early Corbin? Did you have a blacksmith?
Well, they didn't have many jobs that were separate from that railroad, I'll tell you that. It's like I said, there were some of the people that depended on agriculture for a living that lived in the outskirts of Corbin, what's now called West Corbin, was the old Adkins farm. And my recollection of it is that after the Adkins family gave it up and came to Corbin and went to railroad, that place was wide open and was a common. You'd be surprised to know that in the early days of Corbin, nearly every family had a cow of their own, and they had a hog pen, and they raised their own hogs. We did that.
The actual town people of Corbin?
Yes, that was the town people. They supplemented their wages with milk and hog meat. And some of them had chickens, great flocks of chickens. But their chief dependence was the railroad and the railroad payroll.
Was saloon keeping ever a business in Corbin? What? Saloon keeping. Did you have saloons in early Corbin?
The what?
Saloons. Bars?
The whiskey business?
Yeah, whiskey.
How well I remember that. When the people of Corbin organized and rose up against the liquor traffic, there was 22 open saloons there on what's now called Florence Avenue. That runs north and south, east of the railroad. That was the scene of one of the worst tragedies that ever took place in Corbin. There was a young fellow by the name of Raleigh White that undertook to go with one of those off of Jim Shopwell's girls, and Uncle Jim called him a scoundrel and told him to stay away from his home. My recollection of that is that girl's name was Belle. And this Raleigh White killed old man Chopper, and that brought on a regular war. The Whites had moved into Corbin from up in Virginia. It was Max and Bill and Roach and Raleigh, those four boys, and old Grandma White. After her husband died up there in Virginia, she came through Cumberland Gap and came down to Corbin and settled there, hoping that the boys could pick up work with the railroad company. Like I've said before, the old settlers resented some of these that were coming in, and particularly if they were Democrats, because just about that time that Goble and Taylor business was at its height. and they'd preach the regular holy war throughout the mountains that brought about Goebbels' assassination. And these whites were Democrats, and the Shockwells were Republicans, and they didn't like them a bit. Old man Jim Shockwell didn't want him going with one of his girls, and Raleigh White killed that old man right down there in front of one of the saloons. And the Shockwell generation loaded up and went to Lily and secured dynamite there, and you couldn't buy anything like that in Corbin in those days. But up at Lily, there was some coal mining going on, and they had to have explosives. And they went and bought a dynamite. I don't know how much of it or what kind. Brought it back to Corbin and got Clay Kincaid, a colored boy, to crawl under the floor of Max White's restroom and place that. And Clay placed that and put a fuse that came clear to the outside. And that night, about supper time, there was a tremendous explosion there on Florence Avenue, or Saloon Street, as we called it then. And it's been said that there was a man in Max White's restaurant eating his supper, and said he'd always heard of Corbin, he'd come to see some of it. And about that time he went through the ceiling. Of course, that's only a tale that's been formulated and told in connection with the bitterness that existed. I never did believe any part of it. It's possible, but it's not probable.
Well, now, just when did all this take place?
It must have been around 1901 or 2.
Well, now, were there other feuds in Corbin? Were there other feuds in Corbin?
With what?
Any more feuding in Corbin? Did other families do things like this? Was that a common thing, or was that really
unusual?
Well,
there was a whole lot of feuding and fighting. When I was a boy, these two Laurel County men, Lee Reed and Bill McCullum, that lived over on the Kiwi side of the Laurel River, that had it in for one another, and they, one of them, went in the front door of Great Harmon's livery stable, which is where the old 5 and 10 cent store is now. And the other one was shadowing him and watching. And he came in the back door, and the two, it's a wonder I hadn't got killed. I was right there when they shot it out, witnessed every bit of it. And was put on the witness chair to testify in the coroner's inquest of what had happened. They killed each other right there in that livery stable. At one time, Corbin was so rough that there was a little spot north of the town in Laurel County that was known as Hell's Half Acre. And frequently, someone would be murdered there in Hell's Half Acre and dragged out and placed on the railroad track so that the general public would think that the railroad company had killed them with some of their trains. Gambling went on in that Hell's Half Acre, that's what gave it its name. And lots of times they would become infuriated with one another for cheating. And it would end up in a gun battle. And then the others would drag them out and let them pass away on the railroad company's property.
Well, now, when did this liquor and violence go out of Corbin?
Corbin went dry in 1906. My mother was an ardent member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, WCTU. And as a little boy, I belonged to the Loyal Temperance Legion, LTL. And in promoting and getting ready to put the whiskey question to a vote, they held oratorical contests in the various churches. I spoke in those contests, I don't know how many times, and had a medal one time that I won in one of those temperance lectures. I believe it was in 1906 that Corbin voted to put it out, and they never have let it come back.
Well, how long did it take them to get it put out?
Well, they voted in the August election, I believe it is called. And by the 31st day of December, every one of them that was in that business had cashed in and moved out. But about the time that they were supposed to close their doors and get out, Corbin had one of the worst fires that's ever been in the history of the town. Those 22 buildings and some other buildings that were connected with it burned down in one fire. The supposition is that fire was started in Charlie Kincaid's saloon upstairs. That is on the north end of Florence Avenue. And it burned everything on Florence Avenue clear down to Center Street.
Go ahead.
They may have been 25 buildings burned up in that. They were all of wooden construction. The only firefighting equipment they had was to run the railroad company's locomotives up there and their switch engines or yard engines had a hose that could be connected, and the boiler and the pumps would pump water from the tank, locomotive tank, to put on the fire. But you see, in a fire of that proportions, you couldn't get locomotives enough up there to fight that fire. The fire got the best of them. The same thing happened on the west side of Center Street. It burned out completely from the Francis and Steele store all the way up to where the oldest brick building is in town now. And the only reason that brick didn't burn was that there was a little vacant lot between the two, and they could get in there and fight the fire with buckets. Men would pass buckets of water from one to another. They'd make a chain and they could get the water on the blaze that way. That was supposedly set afire by a merchant that moved into the old Jim Gooden store.
Were there any other big fires in Corbin?
Those were the two greatest ones.
Well, you mentioned the fact that this Hell's Half Acre, you said it was part of Corbin, but that it was in Laurel County. Now, just what county is Corbin in?
Well, to be true about the matter, Corbin's in three counties. North Corbin is in Laurel County, and East Corbin is in Knox, and all of Central and West Corbin is in Whitley County.
Now, has that presented problems for Corbin?
What's that?
Has that made a problem for Corbin to be in three counties?
Well, it hasn't so far. Corbin had a problem annexing South Corbin, and I understand that they've got a problem now trying to annex a portion of North Corbin, but I wouldn't say that they've got a problem there. I wouldn't want to stir that resentment up. Where the two nursing homes are out there, they're both outside of the incorporation. They're in Laurel County.
Well, pardon me, I'm going to put another tape in. Following is tape two of an unrehearsed interview with Mr. John D. Pete Feather by Debbie Wilson for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at the Souder Nursing Home in Broadhead, Kentucky on July the 21st, 1978 at 3:30 p.m. Now, Mr. Feather, before we got another tape, we had been talking about Corbin being in three different counties, and you said it made no problem for him, but just what about the citizens of Corbin now? Do they consider themselves county residents of the various counties, or just residents of Corbin, or how does that work?
No, they just consider themselves residents of Corbin.
Well, now, where do the children go to school?
They go to the city school. That was one problem that Corbin had to solve. Originally, they had the old county schools there, and one school way up in South Corbin, and the old Grady school that I went to at 7th and Kentucky, and they had the East Corbin School. And in North Corbin, they had what was called the Phelps Chapel School. Well, that Phelps Chapel School is still there because that's never been incorporated. But when Corbin was formed out of Whitley and Knox counties, they had that problem of being under two school superintendents. And you can just imagine what a problem that was. If you moved from one side of the town to the other, you had to go to school where you moved. You couldn't stay in school on them. And there was a great deal of moving going on among those railroad people because some of them didn't come there as permanent residents. They just came there to work, and when they got as much as they wanted, they'd pull up and go back home where they came from. We had people right here in Rockcastle County that I can name that I worked with. They're dead and gone now. But Mitchell Owens down here at Merrittsburg, I've worked with him many a day right there in the Corbin Yard. Well, he owned a farm up here, and he never had any idea of staying in Corbin permanently. He had a brother that left down there. The Parrott family in Corbin originated up here. We had a locomotive engineer by the name of Lap Parrott, and there was one that was a section foreman of those Parrott boys, and they all originated right here in Rockcastle County. Well, they're still up there. Some of them came up there, lived and died up there, and are buried over there in Pine Hill Cemetery, or that addition to Pine Hill. I believe they call that Memorial Park now. It's just an addition to the old Pine Hill Cemetery, a little bit east of Pine Hill. I haven't got to look that part over because by the time they got that memorial garden open, I was blind and couldn't tell what was going on. Our lot in Pine Hill Cemetery has got my father and mother, three brothers, and one of them's wife buried there. The fourth boy is buried down in Williamsburg. His wife chose to keep him down there with her. That is the youngest one, Brother Joe.
Well, before we leave the three county situation, I want to ask about taxes. Now, how do the people in Corbin pay their taxes?
Well, if you live on the Knox County side, you pay your taxes to the sheriff in Barberville. And if you live on the Whitley County side of it, you pay your taxes to the sheriff in Williamsburg. And of course the city tax.
We'll move off of that subject onto the black situation in Corbin. Now, you mentioned this.
The what?
The Negro situation in Corbin. Do you have Negroes in Corbin?
We have two.
Well, now, I understand that the blacks were forced out of Corbin at one time. Is this...
They were mobbed there. It was a pitiful incident, agitated by a gang of roughnecks. Should never have happened. I had a brother that thought it was a great thing to be out and be messed up and that, and I was coming home from work while it was going on there on Main Street, and I perceived him marching with that crowd, and I called him to one side and told him to get himself up Gordon Street and home just as quick as he could. He told my father after that that I talked mean to him. My father told him that I was telling him exactly what was right. I told him that every one of them would go to the penitentiary. And sure enough, it took everything we could do to keep Brother Ed from going up to the penitentiary.
Well, now, when did this happen?
Well, it is after the new railroad yards were built there, and I don't know just exactly when they were built. Pete Rogers, that they call Pistol Pete, seemed to be in command of that mob. And they were carrying out everything that he suggested. Most of those colored people were out of railroad boarding cars. They were over there in the yard. The railroad company was laying steel for 22 new tracks in what we call the East Yard, and they was building that high line and had those colored people in there to do that heavy work.
Was anyone hurt or killed in this incident?
No.
Well, now what?
Well, the only ones that was hurt was the ones that had to go to pen over it.
What exactly was their reason for this?
They didn't have any reason, only that the colored population was niggers.
And that was just because they were a different color, that was their only...
That was all the reason in the world. The old woman that was responsible for me being in this world, old Aunt Mick Parks, they drove her out. She had ministered to my mother when I was born out there in that west end of Center Street, which was a briar patch then.
Lynette, you mentioned this old lady taking care of your mother when you were born. What were the medical practices in early Corbin?
We didn't have any. We had Aunt Mitt, and she went with the, when the railroad company brought steam wreckers in there, she was the only nurse that we had. She called all the railroad men her boys. And the ones that she helped into this world were her boys. I was one of them. I was her boy. She stopped me a many a time down there on the side of the railroad where she lived and gave me goose eggs. They were great big eggs. I'd take them home and color them have them colored for Easter.
What were some of the old-time remedies that people used since they didn't have regular medical services available?
Well, they had medicines in a way. They used tincture of iodine to treat a wound with, and Epsom salts that came from out here at Crab Orchard. And corn whiskey was used as a remedy.
Well, when did the hospital finally come to Corbin?
The people voted a bond issue and built it out there. I couldn't tell you exactly when that was built.
Well, did Corbin ever have any serious epidemics of any kind?
They used to have smallpox. I've seen the time that we weren't allowed to go down Kentucky Street to the schoolhouse and to keep the general population away from where they had smallpox. That was the epidemic that was most prevalent. It had swept the town from one side to the other. That was before they ever went to vaccine meeting for it. They killed it out after that. Corbin in the west, northwest portion of the town had what they called a pest house. And those people had contracted smallpox. They took them to the pest house. They didn't let them stay in town. And they put a yellow flag on the gatepost to warn you to stay out of there. They realized that that epidemic was a contact disease, and when you came in contact with it, before you knew it, you'd break out with smallpox. And that was what they did to conquer it. We only had two doctors in the town at that time, Dr. J.E. Parker and old Dr. Will Bryant, and a little later Dr. Jasper Bryant. And I doubt a single one of them was the graduate of a medical school. I know that Dr. Jasper Bryant would practice medicine up there during the fall and the winter, and sometimes in the spring he'd pull out and go to Louisville and sit in on the medical lectures that were given down there in the medical school. He stayed pretty well informed and up on things, but it wasn't a rosy path by any means.
Oh, I understand that.
Typhoid fever used to take quite a number of them in the summertime. That is on account of bad water supply and filthy outbuildings. Corbin never had any sewage. That's old. Been put in there in late years. There wasn't a sewer in Corbin to carry off any of that filth. And these outhouses were exposed to the flies, and the flies spread that typhoid. We had a considerable amount of that. And it wasn't only in Corbin, it was up there in Wilton, in the mining camps. Wilton's in Knox County, just 7 miles from Corbin. And I've known them have those fever outbreaks up there. There's a long time that they couldn't do a thing in the world about typhoid fever. They didn't know. They didn't know for a long time how it was spread from one locality to another. They never suspicioned that the flies carried it.
Can you recall any other types of epidemics in Corbin?
Well, nothing only childhood diseases, measles and mumps and things like that. I had them both.
Well, we'll move on then. I understand that one of the Roosevelts visited Corbin. Now, do you know anything about this?
Who is that?
One of the Roosevelts. Was it Teddy Roosevelt, I think, made a trip to Corbin?
Yes, ma'am. I know when he came, or know about when he came. I was right there. Those Republicans, when he got off of that private car, he was on the rear end of it. They picked him up and carried him down to what we call the old ball ground. That was in the Wilder settlement. And they had a platform all decorated with flags for him to speak. That was when he made his campaign on the progressive Republican ticket.
I understand that he made more than one trip to Corbin. Is this correct?
I couldn't tell you about that. I don't know.
I was under the impression that he had been there twice.
Well, it could be that after McKinley was assassinated and Roosevelt became president, that he made a trip up there to garner that mountain vote, and then later came back on the progressive Republican ticket. They called them progressive Republicans the Bull Moose Party.
What about the time that Paley's Comet, I understand that got quite a reaction from the people in Corbin.
About what?
Paley's Comet. Do you remember this incident?
It was 1910.
Now, what did it do to the people in Corbin? How did they react?
Well, some of them were scared to death of it, and there's others was scoffed at the idea of being afraid of it. I went out one night with a party and sat on one of those hillsides to see it, and I didn't see anything so terrifying about it. It just looked like a star with a tail to it, or a streak that went behind it. They had a worse comet in 1862. The one in 1862, I don't remember who, what name it had, but it reached from one side of the horizon to another. Now, Halley's Comet never had no spectacular tail like that. It ought to be about time for it to come back. I think it visits the Earth's visionary point about every 75 years, maybe a little more than that. I'm 82 now. In 1906, I was 10 years old. I was 14 years old in 1910. And there wasn't anything terrifying about Halley's Comet. Oh, some of them thought the world was coming to an end. You might walk out there tonight and discover a comet in the sky and come back and tell it. And there'd be some of them that predict the end of time for the right at hand. People have been doing that for years and years and years.
Well, Mr. Feather, what did you do for entertainment in early Corbin?
Well, I told you that the Masonic Hall, the downstairs portion of that, was the old opera house. And these companies that put plays on the stage used to come through. And they had that. And finally, when the moving picture came, we had a little picture show on the north end of Main Street, right along there where the old, where the Roland building is now. I believe they called that the Palace Theater. I put in a whole lot of my spare time at the picture show, and these stock companies that used to put plays on in the old opera house, and then the Odd Fellows built what's now known as the Majestic Theater. And there's any number of stock companies that would come and play there. In earlier Corbin, there wasn't much you could do that was entertaining, I'll be frank with you.
Well, what type of celebrations did the town have? Did they ever have parades or anything like this?
Yes, on the 4th of July, they'd usually have a big to-do. And the churches at Christmas time, they'd haul in great big spruce trees. They'd have a Christmas tree, what they call a Christmas tree. Every person would take a part in that. and seemed to enjoy it.
Well, we'll move on now to some of the outstanding citizens of Corbin. Who can you name that has been an outstanding citizen in Corbin?
Oh, we've had several of them.
Have you had anyone to actually become famous from Corbin?
D.B. Calvert from over here at Stanford was one of the outstanding citizens. And Mr. J.L. Crawford that's there now. They've honored him in this Nibrock Festival. Did you know that?
Yes, I've heard that.
Well, he's really been beneficial to Corbin because all those factories and things that are there, he's worked to get them there. He didn't bring them there, all of them, but he's answered questions that they ask and would stay in contact with them until they made a decision. He's president of that First National Bank there now.
Pardon me, I'm going to turn the tape over. This is side two of tape two of an interview with Mr. John D. Pete Feather. Now, Mr. Feather, before I turn the tape over, we were discussing outstanding citizens from Corbin. Can you think of any others besides Mr. Calvert and Mr. Crawford?
Well, A.B. Merle and Roger D. Smith, both of them were connected with the railroad company, but they were active citizens, especially at the time of my boyhood. Mr. Smith was named as the superintendent of terminals there, and he was quite active in the downtown business with the merchants and all, even though he was fully employed for the railroad company.
Well, Mr. Feather, we're going to soon be out of time, and I'd just like for you to tell me what you think, you know, just how some of the ways that Corbin has changed over the years.
What I think of Corbin?
Well, what you think of it, or how it has changed, you know, from the time of your boyhood up to the present. Just briefly, some of the major changes.
From the time of my boyhood up till now, my sister informed me that I wouldn't know where I was in Corbin now, that I couldn't find the places that I used to talk about. But I believe she's wrong. I believe I would have kept up with it. I've seen Corbin grow from a town that was classified as the fifth class into a third class city, and I believe that we have every modern convenience there now. And to begin with, we didn't have any of them. They all had to be made. And sometimes, in order to sell the people on ideas, like building that hospital. The city of Corbin voted a bond issue and erected that hospital. Did you know that?
I think you did mention that. So it was a real community effort then.
It was.
Well, now, what could you say about Corbin right now? Could it be classified as perhaps a small industrial city? Does it have some industry now, or is the railroad still the primary industry in Corbin?
No, the railroad is not the primary thing in Corbin now, because there's 10 or 12 other manufacturing plants there. And if I understand it correctly, they're all at work. The railroad company, in recent years, has moved a lot of their clerical force and supervision to Corbin from these outlying points. Corbin now is one of the largest railroad centers on the LN system.
Mr. Feather, before I read this poem that you have written, is there any one sentence or anything that you, just one thing you'd like to say about Corbin to sum up?
Well, to me it's home sweet home.
I'm going to go ahead now, Mr. Feather.
I'd be inclined to paint a brilliant picture of Corbin, because it is home sweet home. I spent 72 years of my life there and 10 years over here in this nursing home.
So you saw a lot of changes in Corbin.
What is that?
So you did see a lot of changes in Corbin
over the years. I should say so.
Well, Mr. Feather, I want to thank you for this interview, and now I'm going to read this poem that you've given me, that you wrote. Now, did you write this poem while you were here in the nursing home?
Right here in the bed.
Okay, well, I'm going to read this on the tape now for you. Today I stand on Jordan's west bank and gaze with rapt attention toward the east. In the not too far distance and in the twilight shadows of my evening hours, I see, but dimly, the promised land. Tomorrow, in the sunlight of God's love, I shall cross the river. I will not be alone, for He will go with me. His hand will guide and sustain me, and then I will see more clearly. In the holy city, the New Jerusalem, and without fear or trepidation, I enter the east gate and stand by the temple there. I hear the angels sing, glory to God, peace on earth, goodwill to men. I can hear my mother's voice as she sings, how great thou art. Out of the medley of other voices, I hear others singing the songs I love. I hear my aunt as she sings, whispering hope.
Hands and voices beckon me to enter the temple, and in the Holy of Holies I stand before the throne of grace. I make my last confession, wholly unworthy. Wholly unworthy, I come just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me. May it be that I shall hear these words, "Well done, thy good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joys of thy Lord. Amen. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many. Enter. Amen."
Tori, put forth enough effort to produce anything similar to that.
It's very beautiful, Mr. Feather.
I had any amount of that stuff in my home when I went blind, but I have a sister that is one of these immaculate housekeepers. Anything that doesn't have utility to her is rubbish, and it goes in the fire.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing that poem with us as well as your time for this interview.